House Judiciary Committee for Tuesday, February 27, 2007. We have just two bills on our agenda today, committee members, which are set for hearing. And although it says possible work session, it's not my intention to bring the work session today. But they're, as you probably saw, they're fairly thick and complicated bills. So we need to start penetrating what's going on in this very exciting area of condominium and planned community operations. Council Kalmanson, could you give us an introduction? I need to open a public hearing on both House Bills 2665 and House Bill 2666. Could you give us general orientation to these bills?
Sure. House Bill 2665 and 2666 both concern the Oregon Planned Community Act, or the OPCA, and the Oregon Condominium Act. 2665 deals mostly with the operational provisions of those statutes, and there's changes in 2665 that concern voting, electronic communication, appointment of receivers, special meetings, insurance, and reserves. The main difference between 2665 and 2666 is that if there were changes to the statutes that mirrored each other, so that you'll see a change that is the same in the Condominium Act and the Planned Parenthood, the Planned Community Act, not Planned Parenthood Act. Don't want to make this more controversial than it needs to be.
It's a little
early. This last night, that's where I ended up.
Right. but if you see something that mirrors the two statutes, it'll be in 2665, so the change will be the same in the Condominium Act and the Planned Community Act. If it's a difference that's on its own, it'll be in 2666. Just very generally, these statutes contain two types of rules, default rules, which are rules that essentially fill a gap if there are if the governing documents of a homeowners association doesn't say anything about a particular subject. These statutes provide sort of default rules that govern these situations, and there are also provisions in there that override the governing documents that say, notwithstanding anything in a governing document, this particular rule will apply. And throughout 2665 and 2666, there are provisions that change both the default rules and things that override a governing document. And I'll just highlight some of the key provisions in each one. In 2665, among other things, the bill adopts procedures allowing an owner in certain instances to ask a court to appoint a receiver to manage the affairs of a homeowners association. It also allows a board of directors of an association to A, obtain insurance for the association that contains a deductible that exceeds the maximum specified in the association's bylaws, B, create a process for payment of the deductible and processing of insurance claims, and C, require the association's owners to obtain insurance beyond that specified in the bylaws. 2665 also requires a board to establish a reserve and draft a plan for maintenance of the property. It permits a board to provide electronic notices to owners and adopt procedures for electronic voting. It requires the recording of votes at board meetings and provides that a director is presumed to have assented to any action of the board if the director is present at the meeting and does not vote against the action or abstain. 2665 establishes procedures for voting by written ballots and holding special meetings, and it provides that directors may not vote by proxy or by secret ballot except for the election of officers. 2665 also precludes the bylaws or the declaration from limiting recovery of attorney's fees by a prevailing party in litigation brought under the statutes, and it applies to pre-2002 planned communities. So that's 2665, and again, I'll give you some the key provisions of 2666. 2666 revises the definition of common property in the Oregon Planned Community Act to include property designated on the plat to be transferred to the homeowners association. It requires an association to incorporate before recording the plat if it contains a conveyance to the association. It permits a declarant under the Oregon Condominium Act to amend the declaration and bylaws to comply with requirements of certain governmental agencies and corporations. The bill establishes that windows and unit access doors are, quote, general common elements of a condominium, but the glazing and the screens are part of the individual units.
Oh my gosh.
It exempts sales of non-residential units from the disclosure statement and related sales procedure requirements. 2666 allows the declarant to convert a leasehold to a fee condominium after approval of 75% of the owners, even if the bylaws require approval by more individuals. The bill requires an association with more than four units to be incorporated and permits a board to incorporate a previously unincorporated association, again, notwithstanding anything provided in the bylaws to the contrary. The bill requires recording of amendments to bylaws that have been approved by the real estate commissioner within 2 years of the approval. And finally, the bill provides that unless the bylaws or declaration says otherwise, a unit owner is responsible for maintenance, repair, and replacement of the unit, while the association is responsible for the maintenance, repair, and replacement of the common elements.
That's it. Council, we have this bill. These bills are the product of a working group of people who are involved with the operation of homeowner associations for condominiums and planned developments on communities. So I'd like to invite several people from that working group forward, Rich Vile, Denise Bauer, and Steve Brodell. To join Mr. Vile at the witness table. Thank you. Mr. Vile.
Thank you, Chair McPherson, members of the committee. We are grateful for the opportunity to appear before you today. We recognize that it's relatively early in the session, but we're nevertheless flattered by the attendance at this committee meeting and hope to provide you with something that has some meaning for you. By way of introduction, my name is Rich Vile. I'm an attorney practicing in the area of homeowner association law. Our firm limits its practice to representing homeowners associations after they have been turned over from the developer to the owners for control. Our working group also has on it lawyers who represent the other side of the equation, those who are helping the developer create homeowners associations. We have managers such as Ms. Bauer, Denise Bauer to my right, who is a manager. We also have homeowner association members of the board of directors or volunteers to the homeowners association. We have accountants, and we have other members of the service organizations that typically interact with homeowners associations on our working group. At the table with me today are two members which have particular interest. Steve Brodell, on my far right, is actually the president of an organization called the Oregon-Washington Community Association Managers. His organization represents all of those companies and individuals who specialize in helping to manage homeowners associations. Ms. Bauer, who is also a manager, is the chairman of the Legislative Action Committee for Community Associations Institute. Community Associations Institute is a national organization with a local chapter that has constituents including the volunteer members of the board and the professionals that serve boards of directors for homeowners associations. With us today, we have other managers, consultants, and volunteer members of the board who have chosen to attend and are available to answer questions should any member of the committee want to ask them. I'd like to take just a moment and give you a little bit of perspective on this phenomenon of homeowner associations. It wasn't until the mid-70s that Oregon began to see significant numbers of homeowner associations. Prior to that time, we had a few, but there was no statute. There were projects like Sun River, for example, that formed in the late 60s that had to have some mechanism of managing the common property, but there was no statute to take care of it. In the mid-70s, we began seeing statutes. We actually had a statute of sorts that dealt with horizontal property, the idea that you could buy a piece of airspace and own your airspace and then own together with everybody else the rest of the building. That came along in the late 60s and early 70s, but it wasn't until the mid-70s that Oregon first adopted a comprehensive statute covering any sort of homeowners association. It only dealt with condominiums, however, and condominiums were only one sort of the homeowner associations that we had in Oregon. Sun River, for example, is not a condominium. Within Sun River, there are condominium projects, but the Sun River development itself is a subdivision. And until 1981, there was no law that dealt with homeowner associations necessary to help manage a subdivision like Sun River. So in 1981, the Planned Community Act was adopted. Therefore, we had post-1981 the Oregon Condominium Act and the Oregon Planned Community Act, one dealing with horizontal properties, meaning airspace-type properties, the other dealing with subdivision-type properties. And in an attempt to help all of us look at the law relating to homeowners associations consistently, we have tried ever since 1981 to, as closely as possible, make the homeowners associations that govern both these types of properties operate consistently. As Matt said, much of what you see, virtually all of what you see in 2665 is an attempt to continue to correct things that were inconsistent in one, or that were inconsistent between them, that didn't affect the fact that the properties have slightly different ways of operating, so that they might operate the same. So that's essentially 2665. 2666 looks at the fact that we continue to learn how homeowner associations are able to be created in ways that will successfully allow them to operate. It's important that you understand that a homeowners association is essentially the creation of the developer. In fact, some states have advocated for the appointment of sort of a guardian ad litem for the young homeowners association while the developer is still in control, so that it will not be subjected to unreasonable control by this developer, whose legitimate objectives are to make money and may not be fully considering the needs of the homeowners association after control has been turned over. So some of the provisions in 2666 address that sort of thing. Let me give you an example. In fact, it's the last provision of 2666, and it talks about attorney's fees. This may be perhaps the most controversial of all of the elements of the two bills. The attorney's fee provision.
Which section of Mr. File is that?
Let me get my section out.
You see, it's the last section of the bill, which looks to me to be section 21, starting on page 27 of 2666. 22, I guess, starting on 28.
Yeah. Yes, it's 21 and... It's 21 and 22.
I thought that was in 2665.
Oh, okay. That's my problem. I've got the wrong bill. Thank you, Chair McPherson. Okay, so it's two places because it affects both statutes. If you want to look at the first place that appears, it is Section 17. Okay. What it does, it takes out the provision unless otherwise provided in the declaration and bylaws. Now let me explain why that's important. The condominium, which Section 17 refers to, and later it's the mirrored provision of the Planned Community Act, is formed and governed by a declaration and bylaws. If the declaration were to say, as some have, the homeowners association may not spend more than X thousand dollars on litigation unless approved by all of the owners, then the homeowners association, if it had a claim against the developer for construction defects, for example, might find itself unable to pursue that claim because the statute previously said, unless otherwise provided in the declaration of bylaws, you can get attorney's fees. That has been one of the results of creative efforts by some few developers' counsel to limit the ability of the homeowners association to bring legitimate claims. This deals with that kind of problem. And simply by eliminating the phrase, unless otherwise provided in the declaration of bylaws, it provides an override to the declaration of bylaws that allows attorney's fees to be recovered. So, that is the type of thing that in the bill is designed to help a homeowners association operate more effectively. Now let's take a look at another one that may be less controversial, for example. The insurance provisions. Okay. Beginning with section 3 of 2665, and then again the mirrored provisions for the Planned Community Act are back in 31, but I think we can just focus on section 3. We have this problem that has occurred. Once again, declarations and bylaws form the governing documents for a homeowners association. If the declaration and bylaws, for example, say the association must purchase insurance with no greater than a $1,000 deductible to cover all of the common elements, and the insurance industry, as both of my colleagues at the table will tell you, is now at the point where they won't sell you a $1,000 deductible on the kinds of buildings that we're dealing with. Or if you want a $1,000 deductible, it's 10 times more expensive than maybe a $10,000 deductible might be. And your declaration says otherwise. We have no mechanism now to override the declaration. So once again, this bill would allow you to override the declaration and provide for a level of deductible that would allow the association to purchase its insurance, whereas the current direct declaration may make it impossible or very, very difficult.
Mr. Now, in addition, can I just break in with a question on that? And what is the typical voting requirement in order to make a change in a declaration or a bylaw? Surely it doesn't require a unanimous vote of all the unit holders in a planned community or a condominium?
The default, Chair McPherson, members of the committee, the default in the current statutes for a change to the declaration is 75%. However, the declaration may require a greater percentage for certain things. The default for bylaws, which are the operational document, is 50%. And once again, the statute allows for some flexibility to make it higher for certain things. But the problem with a 75% vote is this, and we'll talk about this a little bit later when we talk about another provision. We do not get typically anywhere close to that amount of participation in most homeowners associations. Folks just simply don't get that involved. And so this is not a 75% vote of those present at a meeting called for the purpose. It's 75% of the entire association. That can be virtually impossible to get, even on an issue like overriding a deductible.
Thank you.
So that is one of the very important reasons why the overrides in the proposed legislation can be important. Let's look at another issue. Often, the documents, the declaration and or bylaws, don't say anything about who has to pay the deductible in case there's a loss that affects both the common elements and the individual unit. Now, owners should carry their own insurance. If you're familiar with renter's insurance, you want to buy a policy that covers the contents of your apartment if something happens to the building. The landlord carries a policy to replace the building. In a condominium environment, it's very similar. You want to carry a policy that covers the contents of your unit, and you want to have the association carry a policy that covers the whole building. Well, often there is a conflict because the deductible for the building as a whole may be $5,000, maybe $2,000, maybe $10,000, depending on what size building and what kind of insurance needs to be purchased. But when a loss occurs, if it's the fault or if it originates in a unit and the unit owner has some coverage but their deductible is also high, the owner's association's policy may cover it, but their deductible is also high, no one knows for sure who should pay that deductible. The law now does not have any help for us to adopt any kind of policy that would allocate that deductible responsibility. This provision would allow the board of directors of the condominium or homeowners association to adopt a resolution, just like adopting any resolution, after a hearing, after giving folks an opportunity to be present, just like your process. But then that resolution would allocate the responsibility for the deductible. And it would also, if it allocates the responsibility for the deductible to the owner, for example, it would be required that the owner was given notice of that, and it allows the association to require the owner to carry insurance to cover their portion of the deductible. Right now, the owner policy insurance companies say, we're not paying that. That's the association's responsibility. They're the one that had the deductible. So the process then simply allows the board of directors of the association, without the need to try and get a 75% vote, to figure out how to allocate that sort of thing. Okay, there are other provisions relative to insurance, but I want to turn now to one other interesting and I think important provision. Developers often have a problem in getting to the point that they no longer hold enough units to control the board of directors. And just as an aside, let me tell you that most of the time developers simply appoint themselves, members of their companies, as the board of directors while they still own most of the units. As you sell units and you get closer to turnover, the current law requires a transition committee, so the developer appoints members that have purchased units from him to serve on this transition committee. But the actual control of the board of directors doesn't switch until a vote is taken and the homeowners themselves, who have enough now of the units to be able to constitute a majority, step in and vote in their own board of directors. What happens when the developer has created the bylaws so that a quorum for a meeting at which directors can be elected is 50% or more, and not 50% show up to the meeting that the developer calls? Is the developer stuck having to continue wearing a director's hat forever? Well, all of us, and particularly the management companies that deal with this on a regular basis, have determined that that simply doesn't work and that we need to have provisions that will allow the developer to be able to move on, reduce quorum requirements, and if no quorum ever occurs, or if the owners just simply refuse to put up a member of the board of directors, a process can take place. Section 2 of 2665 deals with the process of if the association, whether at turnover or not, fails to get a quorum, you can begin to reduce the quorum requirements. You can reduce them consecutively in meetings so long as you don't go below 20% until you get enough folks there to elect your board of directors. That can happen, and if that never happens, then the law allows a receiver, the court, to appoint a receiver or other judicial process so that the developer is no longer required to sit there and manage the association that he no longer owns units or no longer has a controlling number of units in. That process, we have already been operating under that process without the benefit of statutory consent for some time. It happens often enough that we've already kind of done our own thing to try and make it work. But unfortunately, without a statutory allowance, it has been difficult.
Representative Compton, do you have a question?
Yes. Thank you, Chair McPherson. You said you've been doing this for some time. That's a very general term. What is some time? 6 months or 6 years or 26 years?
Chair McPherson, Representative Comp, I've been doing this for 30 years. And in the rare occasion where we can't get the quorum necessary, we have gone to court over that 30-year period and gotten a judge to appoint receivers so that at least we had someone to be responsible for the operation of the association. But we never had a statute that said we could before. We've just done it and hoped the court would recognize it.
Thank you.
Okay. Other provisions of 2665 include voting by written ballot in circumstances that weren't previously provided for, once again, to address this problem of nobody showing up to meetings. One in particular that I'd like to draw to your attention is the electronic communication provision. Section 4 and Section 20 specifically address the electronic notices, and Section 5 and Section 21 address the electronic voting provisions. Electronic notices and electronic voting are necessary because current law talks in terms only of notices by mail or personal delivery. As you can imagine, many associations now are populated by folks who prefer to receive their notices and would prefer to vote by electronic means. The statute does not say you have to do it. The proposed changes do not say you have to do it. The proposed changes simply allow the board of directors to adopt rules that then become something that the association can use to effectively use email for notices and electronic voting procedures. We believe that we have provided in the statute direction so that associations will take care to include in their resolutions appropriate measures to protect the interests of the individual members. Interestingly, there was some discussion about this issue early in the genesis of the idea, and it was this. Well, it's simply not fair to begin using electronic notices or electronic voting when there are some people that don't have computers. And we acknowledge that that may be the case. The statute requires that if there is someone who wants to opt out, doesn't want to get their notice by electronic voting or doesn't want to, by electronic or doesn't want to participate in electronic voting, that the association must provide an alternative means. But I think it was an AARP representative who finally said, I guess we don't require that everyone have a car in order to get to a legislative hearing. I suppose we don't necessarily have to worry that everyone doesn't have a computer to get their notice as long as we provide alternative means. And so that provision appears now to have the support of all of the various constituencies that are looking at this particular bill. The only other one that I thought I might address with you in 2665, just by way of a quick summary, is the reserves and reserve study provisions found in Section 7 and Section 23. Reserves are something that every association deals with, and let me explain what they are. For a number of years, particularly West Coast states have required homeowners associations to try and avoid the situation where suddenly every owner in the project is hit with a very, very large assessment to cover a replacement item such as a roof. It's extremely difficult, especially in projects that have mostly retired folks in them, for them to suddenly get a bill for $15,000, which is their share of the replacement of a roof. In order to avoid that, many years ago, our statute required reserves to be collected by the Homeowners Association. Now, last session, the developer lobby, in an effort to try and address the issues that have been so controversial regarding construction defects, said, you know, we know that we have some problems, but we think a lot of our problems are because the Homeowners Association is not maintaining. Now, this is kind of related to reserves. So last session, the legislature adopted a requirement for a maintenance study. And the maintenance study was included in and tied to the reserve portion of the statute. Some confusion has emerged as a result of that in the last couple of years since the last session. The confusion is, does the maintenance study obligation only relate to those items which will need replacement between 3 and 30 years, which are the reserve items? Or does it relate to everything in the association that needs maintenance? This bill simply clarifies that even though they appear in relatively the same part of the statute, the maintenance study and the reserve study are not necessarily tied together in that sense. The maintenance study is broader. It requires maintenance of everything, even those items that need maintenance in less than 3 years. I see some head shaking and eye glazing. I'm happy to answer a question on that. I fear I've caused more confusion than helped with that explanation.
Why don't we pause and give the committee an opportunity to ask questions if they have any for Mr. Vile. Representative Wisdom.
I have several. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Did your work group have any minority reports or people that were this, you know, strong anti your recommendations to this committee?
Chair McPherson, Representative Wisnott, we did not have anyone that ultimately had any objection to any of the provisions. In the early stages, we had vigorous discussions about a number of the things, but what you see before you reflects a consensus, and okay. No one in our groups have had any serious problems with any of the things that are here.
Thank you. Follow on. Did your work group have representatives from all sizes of homeowner groups?
Chair McPherson, Representative Wisnott, yes, they did. We have representatives from organizations. Mr. Brodell's organization, for example, manages many homeowners associations which have very little common area, maybe a sign, maybe some streets that they have to maintain, but they don't maintain the exterior of the homes. Ms. Bauer's organization, on the other hand, does primarily management for large high-rises with very complex systems. We had members of boards of directors, volunteers, from those same sizes and types.
Okay. The next follow-up, and probably my last for this go-around. I've lived in Sun River since 1990. I've been an owner, so I'm familiar with homeowners associations. I served on the board. I've been to one of your training programs. I'll vote against this bill because I'm also a member of a two-unit condominium association, and I can't do this. You're asking me and my neighbor to do things that I can't do. A reserve fund for the roof. You have no outs for a two-unit condominium.
Chair McPherson, Representative, who's that? Chair McPherson?
Yes.
We do have a number of limitations in the bill, and the cutoff is actually 4 units. However, as Chair McPherson and I discussed early on, this is a very complex bill, and I understand that the committee is not moving on this bill today. We would welcome. We did not have input, although we had a number of folks from a lot of different sizes. We did not have input from anybody in your specific situation. We recognize its we recognize it's a problem, and we actually did try to address it. But I would invite the representative to look at the provisions, and I do not think that you would find any opposition whatsoever from anyone in this group to setting limits on what a small project. We've used 4 as the cutoff. Other states have used 5, but we recognize there are some real limitations, and we would welcome the input on that.
Thank you. I'm sorry then for that to comment on that or to follow up on that then. So are you saying, because I did see in 266 that they said 4 units, but in 265, are there out for units, condominium units of 4 units or less?
Chair McPherson, Representative Whisnett, we did not make any changes to the provisions in the 465 group of things that would have addressed that limitation. So no, we didn't address that here. Reserves have for many, many years covered the small ones. But again, we would welcome the discussion, and I do not think you'd find any problem with working on those.
Thank you. Okay. Last comment, that I did get input from Sun River Homeowners Association, and they thought they could live with most of these. They do have, in Sun River, we have a consolidated plan which supersedes would take precedence over some of the things you're describing here, but they saw no major problems with the bill. A two-unit condominium unit does.
And Chair McPherson, Representative Whiston, I will tell you that we recognize that the legislation, even as amended, still provides a baseline. It is designed to be applicable so that associations have the basic things that they need to operate. We appreciate and we recognize that many associations do more and go over and above this, and we think that's laudable. Thank you.
Representative Karp, did you have a question?
Yes, I'm just trying to apply this, so thank you, Chair McPherson. In my district, which encompasses Woodburn, we have a Homeowners Association of Senior States. It's been there many years, and in the past 5 years, there has been deep consternation because most of the homeowners that are there now, the percentage of them, are not golfers. And so part of their bylaws talks about the reserves for not only just the well that gives them water, but, you know, taking care of the short-term and long-term needs of that golf course. And they're being charged an incredible additional amount in the past few years. Is this what we're talking about in our reserve plan? Or, I mean, do they have options, or are they stuck with their bylaws?
Representative McPherson, Representative Comp, the problem that you've described at Woodburn Senior Estates is not necessarily unusual around the state.
I didn't think so.
And we have provisions in the law that were adopted back in the early 90s that allows the association, by a vote of its owners, to essentially eliminate a common maintenance obligation, such as a swimming pool or a golf course or something that no one's any longer using. That's in the current law, so none of the changes that we're addressing would affect that.
Okay.
However, until the association chooses to take that step, obviously the reserves would apply. They've got to decide to get rid of it, or if they don't decide to get rid of it, as long as they keep it, then they have to maintain reserves for it.
Any further questions? Well, then what?
I have a representative. I was going to let the rest of the committee. Thank you,
okay.
Mr. Chair.
Okay.
You did make a statement that other states have similar type bills. Are you looking at those when you had drafted the bill? And how do timeshare people, how are they affected?
That's a good question.
In this, some of the units in Sun River are timeshare, and I know they are also. And the final thing is, you talked a little bit about developers taking over, but I know in some of my past experience with developments, you know, are you addressing that of how quickly the homeowners or the ratio, and is that addressed? I have not read that in detail as far as turning over from the developer to the homeowners.
Chair McPherson, Representative Whiston, the provisions requiring the developer to turn over control of the association are not being fussed with in this bill. They've been around for about 18 years, and essentially they require the developer to turn over control as soon as 75% of the units have been sold. And again, we're not messing with that on this particular time. To answer your other question, we have looked carefully at the Uniform Condominium Act and the Uniform Common Ownership Interest Act. Those two acts together have been adopted by about 30 states. And whenever we make legislative changes, we look at those other acts. I will tell you that you in the Oregon legislature should be a little bit of proud of yourselves, because frankly the legislature has adopted what we believe is a better comprehensive system than any of the nationally adopted uniform acts have. We've tweaked, and you should feel comfortable that we have a better system even than most states.
Timeshare.
Oh, thank you. And the timeshare provisions are addressed so that the timeshare projects would also be provided for in the House Bill 2666, which we haven't talked about yet, essentially incorporating these provisions into projects that are primarily timeshare that have the same characteristics.
Thank you.
Good job.
Mr. Brown, you've spoken mainly to 2665. Are you planning a separate presentation on 2666, and do you think it's logical to proceed to those provisions if you are, before we move the other witnesses about either or both of these bills?
I think it might merit just a couple of comments about 2666, Mr. Chairman. Chair McPherson, members of the committee, House Bill 2666, as Matt indicated, is primarily dealing with things that affect the creation, amendment of these projects, and therefore it tends to be much more targeted at either the Condominium Act or the Planned Community Act, because with respect to creation and amendment issues, often those two are somewhat distinct. Talks about the time of incorporation of the association, for example, requires it to be incorporated prior to recording the plat of the property, so you don't get the cart before the horse. You create the interdependent relationships of the owners, and you still haven't incorporated an association. Talks about some key definitions, and let me address those for a moment. Section 5 of 2666 addresses the definition of common elements. Common elements in a condominium project are critical because, and this bill later makes this even clearer, the association is responsible for their maintenance. Now, for many years, developers made the windows, including the window frames, part of the unit and not part of the common elements. But the problem was, when the windows leaked, they leaked into the wall, which was the common element, and now there's a big fight about who's maintaining what and who's responsible for the damage that occurred when the window leaked. This bill would make clear that the default for common elements is the glass belongs to the owner, so the owner has to repair or replace the glass. But everything else appurtenant to the window is part of the common elements. So that if it leaks, that's the association's responsibility. If it causes other damage, everything is tied in together. That was a fairly major glitch in the law that we believe constitutes a significant improvement to now have fixed. It expands this definition of the default definitions to doors and other things similar to what I've just described. And it clearly helps us to make sure that we've got that maintenance obligation understood by the association. Section 9 and 10 of the bill removes the definition of a dwelling unit under the landlord-tenant law from the general definition section. There was confusion. The landlord-tenant definition of a dwelling unit and the definition of a unit in the Planned Community and Condominium Acts really act very differently. And so we simply now have our own definition rather than trying to refer over to the Landlord-Tenant Act. One of the things that has happened in our increasingly complex real estate industry is that people are creating condominium units out of condominium units. In certain places, a condominium unit may have been described as a 5,000 square foot unit, and people are now coming in and saying, you know, we want to split that 5,000 square foot unit into 1,000 square foot units, and so we're creating condominiums within condominiums. We had no mechanism within the statute to allow that to occur, and so we've added that to create additional flexibility for developers who may be looking at further subdividing the condominium unit itself. Leasehold condominiums were referenced by Matt in his introduction. We had a problem with leasehold condominium units because there was nothing in the statute that allowed the association to change so that its common elements became the property acquired. This doesn't change the need for the association to acquire from the lessor the property. It simply changes the ability to get that acquired property then as part of the condominium. It's simply a mechanism to help address those not necessarily numerous, but certainly significant number of projects who in the 70s were created on 30 or 40 or 50 year leaseholds. Nobody in those days, I suppose, thought that we were all going to make it that long, but we have, and now the association is purchasing from the developer, the original lessor, those leasehold interests and bringing them in as part of the condominium. Some disclosure things as to how much unit area is actually, how much square footage is actually in the unit, making sure that that is required in the declaration. Some amendment provisions to address the problem that we have sometimes when amendment requirements in the declaration don't square with the common requirements of Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, or other financing institutional requirements. We've cleared up the fact that if the declaration's not clear on it, the unit owner is required to maintain their unit, and the association is required to maintain all common property. That has been the subject of some controversy. Why, I don't know, but it has been. And then finally, we exempt the sale of non-residential units from the disclosure statement and related sales procedure requirements. We do have a representative of the real estate division here with us today, and I know Lori would be happy to address this if you have any questions about it, but all it does is make clear that the seller of a office condominium project, for example, is not required to go through all the same disclosures that we have for the consumer protection in residential units. I think that's enough to give you a good overview of the two bills, and I appreciate very much your attention.
Okay, if there are no questions for Mr. Vile, then why don't we hear from Ms. Bauer.
Representative McPherson, I'm basically here just to help answer questions. He's given a good recap, and I'd be happy to answer any of the questions that I might be able to answer maybe differently or in another format than Mr. Vile.
Thank you, Ms. Bauer. And Mr. Brodell, did you have any remarks, or are you in the same situation?
We're in the same situation,
okay.
Sir.
Okay, very good.
Can you ask them to describe what kind of units you represent and what's your own ownership and experience?
Okay. I'm Denise Bauer. I'm Vice President of Community Management Incorporated, which is a management company that's been in business since 1972. We manage 117 different communities, ranging from zero lot lines, boat moorages, high rises, condominium associations. I think the smallest community we have is around 12. The largest we have is in 800-900 units. I'm also on the board of directors for Community Association Institute, the Board of Trustees actually, which is the national organization with 28,000 units involved in the community association.
That's 28,000 different projects representing millions of homeowners.
Right. I'm already introduced as the president of the Legislative Action Committee for that same organization. I'm also involved with Government Affairs and Legal Action for the Home Builders Association. Did I answer all your questions? Okay.
Ms. Brodell, why don't you just describe your background and perspective on these matters?
I'm Steve Brodell. I am the chairman of ALCAM. We are a training organization for community managers statewide, and it encompasses not only Oregon but Southwest Washington as well and Eastern Washington. And it's training bringing continuity to all of us that are involved as community managers across the industry, bringing some level of sameness to all of us, and in concert with groups that Denise is working with, we have sat down and come to truly an agreement on both the bills you see before you. We feel like they will satisfy some blank spaces and give us some latitudes that were necessary over the years. I am the Executive Vice President of Northwest Community Management. We manage about 340 communities, ranging in size from 1,200 units to 4-unit condos, and everything in that range you can imagine, about 50,000 homes here in the here in our great state. And just the basic everyday working life, I believe both these bills really will help in clarification in both fields.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Brodell. This is an observation. While this is highly technical subject matter, I'm sure the committee has had the reaction to it. It has a major impact on the lives of Oregonians, and many of us, including myself, live in a condominium townhouse, and so increasingly these are the ways that our lives are controlled, and very significant economic stakes or issues are worked out. Question for both Mr. Brodell and Ms. Bauer: is there any perspective in the activities surrounding planned communities and condominiums that was not represented in the working group that brought forward this bill? Any group or its economic interest or class of participant in the process who should have been at the table and wasn't?
You know, Mr. Chairman, not to my knowledge. Really, we've taken into consideration work with developers in portions of this, listened to them, listened to owners, volunteers. Volunteers drive most of Oregon, and we're pretty excited about that. And they have driven a great part of this as we've listened to them. But over the years, just watching where the loopholes are and tightening up what we do, it's filled, as you said, with technical information, but it really is the everyday life of a greater majority of all of us every day. And but I think for the most part, and Denise probably can say the same, I haven't heard anything out in the wind, nothing in the closets of any sort of struggles.
Okay, very good. Ms. Bauer, the same?
Chair McPherson, the group that I'm involved with is probably the most diverse of the three groups. The working group is generally attorneys for the most part, although has other representatives as well, and ALCAM represents mostly managers, where CAI represents all the service providers within the industry, as well as homeowners, volunteers, and managers, just the whole gamut. We did talk to the banking group, as well as the real estate group. In fact, there's a similar bill that's being presented by a bank that was originally in our bill that was taken out of our bill. So accountants, consultants, homeowners, I can't think of a group that we haven't touched.
Mm-hmm. Okay, very good. Any other questions? Council Kimmins.
I just want to get back to this disclosure provision that you referenced, which was, it's in 2666, and I think it's section 6, and it exempts non-residential units from certain disclosure requirements. I was wondering if you could just go into a little more detail. What are those requirements that they now have that they wouldn't have? And are there other requirements that otherwise apply to these types of units, other types of disclosure requirements?
Representative McPherson, members of the committee, I think it's section 6.
8, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Disclosure regarding
areas. No,
I think it's 6 or
2666. Yeah. If you look, one of the very unfortunate things about testifying before the legislature on homeowner association bills is frequently the legislative council is left without any choice but to include page after page after page of existing text with a little tiny one-word change in it. So we end up with these very thick bills that may not make a lot of changes, and this section is one of them. Section 6 on page 8 of 2666 really goes through and talks about provisions that define condominium and then what application they have to which portions of the statute. And all it says, to answer Matt's question, is that if you look over on page 9 at line 4, there's a whole laundry list of sections that now do not apply to non-residential condominiums. If you look at every one of those sections, it's only whether they have to fill out and give to purchasers a disclosure document that says, you know, you're going to have to pay assessments and you're in this with everybody else and all the things that we require a consumer to be given. The idea is, and the philosophy is, that a business purchaser of a condominium unit that is not to be used for residential purposes has more of a caveat emptor approach to that business transaction and does not need the full disclosure. That has been the practice. That has been the way that the real estate division has operated for many years. It was not as clear in the statute as it could have been, and to, in essence, reflect accurately in the statute what the practice has been, this proposal was put forward. My recollection is that it was provided, it was requested by those who represent a lawyer who represents many developers of condominium units, does disclosure statements all the time for residential purposes, not necessarily someone who's opposed to disclosure statements, but merely reflecting the business reality that when the lawyer buys his office condo, the same types of disclosures are probably not necessary. And again, that is the practice that we have been operating under for a long time. It just wasn't clear in the statute.
Any further questions? Representative Wisner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think from some of your literature and my training, I think to comment on the Chair's comments, I believe that like two-thirds of homes now are in homeowners associations in America or some large number like that. That's just a comment. Look, I'm going to be a member of too many homeowners associations. The thing that we all hate is the term special assessments. And I don't see, you know, that that's addressed in here. And I guess I'm trying to read Section 7. Maybe I should have read it more careful last night. But you've gone from just establishing a reserve account to shall establish a reserve account. And I think that's another problem in homeowners associations is, you know, I read this and I'm still not sure you're not giving guidelines like how you're establishing that. Are you doing that quarterly or every 4 years? In other words, in Sun River, we capitalize every piece of equipment from day one we buy it. We start doing a reserve so that when 30 years when the fire engine or the plow goes out, we got a replacement money's there for it. So you don't really address that of how you're establishing the reserve account from day one, or, you know, do you have to capitalize it, or how you're doing that? Is that, and I think that is, I'm sure you know that from your experience of special assessments and reserve funds or controversy.
Chair McPherson, Representative Bisnett, in fact, the managers will tell you that the best way to finally get owners to show up to do business at a meeting is to put the word special assessment in the notice somewhere, even if you're not actually intending to impose it. You're absolutely right. Special assessments are the bane of every homeowner association's existence, not to mention the homeowners themselves. The current law requires the developer to set up that reserve account at the time the project is created. Now, we've got older projects that wasn't around at the time. Sun River's one of them. Fortunately, Sun River's done a good job of filling in the gaps. Not all have. And so I won't tell you that we don't have problems with reserves, but with projects that have been done since about 1983, 82, we have reserves because the developer was required to do it. Now, what it says in the current law, and we haven't tweaked with this at all, is that we haven't said how you do this because there are lots of ways accountants can come up with numbers. But you are required to create a reserve account for anything that needs replacement between 3 and 30 years. So, and every year, your association looks at that and says, how's our stuff doing? 1 year, a particular truck may appear to have more than 3 years left in it, and the next year, after it's gone through a tough season, it may only have a year left in it. So now you are required to take that reserve and replace the truck. Same thing for roof. 1 year, it may look like it's got 20 years left, and so you only need to put 1/20th of its cost away. The next year you had a bad windstorm and now it's only got 10 years left. You got to adjust your reserve account. So the current law, and we have not messed with this, requires the board every year to look at that and think about, do we need to adjust our reserve account? It's not a perfect system, Representative Wisnett, but we do believe that it has done a great deal to help enhance the security of owners and homeowners associations in Oregon.
Thank you, Chair.
Lieutenant Krieger.
Just a comment. It would appear that the free enterprise system is doing a better job than we are as far as providing for school infrastructure by having something put away. Renovation of the wings we're looking at, you know, went from $17 million to $35 million because we've hesitated 5 years. Perhaps the state should take a lesson from it.
Anybody who's admired the carpet in the House and Senate wings probably would agree with that, Representative Krieger. Any further questions for this panel? Then thank you very much for the presentation. We have two other witnesses, Judy O'Coolidge and Rich Thompson. They could come forward.
I'll stay up here.
And in any order the two of you prefer, and if your perspective is just to share kind of what your vantage point is on this working group and the work product we have before us, that would be just helpful for us to hear that.
I'm Rich Thompson. I am a private consultant working with homeowner associations. I specialize in doing reserve studies. I actually co-wrote the reserve study legislation that the legislature approved in 1999, which addresses Representative Wisnett's question about these issues. It was a significant piece of legislation. We're refining it a bit more in our proposal here today to improve it. But as it's pointed out by Representative Krieger, the idea of setting money aside and planning for future expenses is not only critical to homeowner association, it's ideally suited for governmental and other private agencies that often fail to do the same thing. So we've been able to put this legislation in place. We feel it's been a great boon to Oregon homeowner associations. And as Rich said, we feel that we are ahead of most states in these kinds of things. I'm also the president of what's called the Association of Professional Reserve Analysts, which is a national trade organization. Other states have been encouraged to model what Oregon has been doing in this regard. So our organization, I'm also the executive director of the Oregon-Washington Community Association Managers, of which Steve Riddell is the president. we feel that this legislation that Rich has been talking at length about is consumer-friendly. It certainly helps managers do their job better, and but at the same time, protecting the interests of consumers.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Thompson. Ms. Okulich.
Chairman McPherson and members of the committee, my name is Judy Okulich, and I am the president of Madison Heights Condominium Owners Association. Madison Heights is a condominium association in West Lynn. It's a 96-unit association, and I have been the president for the past 2.5 years. And unlike the others who do this as part of their professional life, I am the volunteer. And I have seen the boards work with these difficult issues. And anything that this committee can do to help clarify for boards who have to be responsible to the owners in terms of making this an easier job for all of us who do this, as I said, as volunteers, is why I'm here today, and I am in support of the bill as described by Mr. Vile.
I might just mention, Chair McPherson, that Ms. Coolidge is also one of the two volunteer members of the committee that Ms. Bauer is president of, the Legislative Action Committee for Community Associations Institute.
And let me add my thanks, Ms. Okulich, to your service as a volunteer, both in this working group and in your own condominium association. It is residents like me who depend on the labors of our neighbors who undertake this responsibility, and we're greatly indebted to them.
You have served on the board?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I've been in legislative service since I
until you're on a home one. Then.
That would seem tough politics if you've seen that. Are there any questions for this panel at this point? Then thank you very much for your attendance. We'll be studying the bills further and open to any further thoughts people have about revisions that may need to be made and then bringing them back.
Chair McPherson, before you close the public hearing, I have one observation that a colleague reminded me of. In the present law, answering Representative Wisnett's earlier question about a two-unit project, the owners can opt out of reserve requirements on an annual basis. So if there's only two of you and you agree, you're in pretty good shape. You can get out of the requirement to have to do that. But again, we would certainly welcome any comments and like to address those kinds of problems should any member of the committee have them that wants to bring them to our attention. Thank
Very
you
good.
Again.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Vile. I'll close the public hearing on House Bills 2665 and 2666. Members, that concludes our agenda. Thank you very much for your attendance.
And we're adjourned.